Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radio Lab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radio Lab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and you probably know my next guest, Mark Bittman, as food columnist for the New York Times, where he combines both the politics and the pleasures of eating. His columns have covered everything from farming policy to fad diets to fast food, and many of them are compiled for the first time in a new book called A Bone to Pick, The Good and Bad News About Food, with wisdom and advice on diets, food safety, GMOs, farming, and more. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here, Brian. Nice to see you.
So let me start here. Americans spend less than 10% of our income on food, you remind us. Why is food so cheap now, and why do you think that's a problem?
Well, good question. Food's cheap because it contains mostly cheap, mass-produced, industrially produced ingredients. But that's not news to most people who know about food, but there's a component here that hasn't been talked about much until recently, and that is the relationship between food and income or wages. And they, no pun intended, feed on one another. We have cheap food and we have low wages, and low wages are dependent on cheap food, and cheap food is dependent on low wages. So the lesson I've learned in writing this column for 4.5 years is that you can't talk about food without talking about everything else. And you really can't talk about improving the food system without talking about improving economic justice.
With so many people already struggling to provide food for their families, how do you justify raising the cost of food?
It has to happen hand in hand with raising the standard of living. It has to happen hand in hand with something like a guaranteed basic income. We need to be able to spend more food. We need to be able to spend more money on food, which means we need to have more money. But until we do that, we can't possibly achieve a sustainable food system, which means we're exploiting workers, we're exploiting animals, we're damaging the earth, and so on.
And interestingly, the last column included in your book compares the long shot goals of creating a healthy food system to raising the minimum wage to $15.
Which is, I won't say prescient, but it pays to remember that 2 years ago people scoffed and laughed at the fight for 15, and now we're seeing one big city after another going that way.
Right. L.A. will gradually get there over the next few years, but it's now a matter of law there. And you responded in one of your recent columns to something NYU professor of nutrition Marion Nessel said on our show last month about how the food movement is winning, but you wrote that you're not even sure the food movement exists.
I don't know if the food movement is winning, and I don't know whether it exists, but I think the fact that people who are interested in food, self-described foodies, now recognize that there are labor issues associated with food issues is a real sign of maturity. I think it's a really good thing.
There's a difference between foodies, as we usually use that word, which is people who are particular about food, people who have refined tastes, who know, what the restaurants are doing, all of that stuff, and the politics of food, as I think you meant it in the rest of that answer, right?
There is a difference. I did write a column somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I did write a column last summer about redefining foodie because, I think that if you're interested in food, it should mean more than you can get a cool reservation at the new restaurant. I think it should mean you care about where food is from and how it's produced, and I think more and more people do, and I think that's a sign that if we don't have a food movement, I mean, that's a judgment call. Of course we have a food movement, but that's a sign of maturity.
There must be some kind of movement because we see Chipotle and McDonald's and other places announcing these new sourcing standards. So that pressure is coming from somewhere.
The pressure is coming from somewhere. Chipotle has been pretty principled about sourcing from the start. McDonald's wavers, and McDonald's is in trouble, so they're responding to a perceived public pressure that may or may not exist to make their to have their food sourced better. But you know, millennials, according to probably the pollsters who were just in here, the millennials care more about these things than baby boomers have.
And they're tired of hamburgers.
I guess, and they're tired. I'm waiting for fast food 3.0. I think Chipotle was a huge step forward, really a great stride. I'd like to see what comes next. We haven't seen a real advance in fast food in a long time.
Do you have a vision for it?
I thought I had a vision for it, but I think it's going to have to come from someone more visionary than I.
Mark Bittman is my guest, food columnist for the New York Times, and author of a book, which is a collection of his columns, A Bone to Pick, The Good and Bad News About Food, with wisdom and advice on diets, food safety, GMOs, farming, and more. A Bone to Pick. If you have a question for Mark Bittman, we can take a few. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we've been talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership on our show a lot recently. And you also write about how free trade agreements reshape the food economy.
Well, NAFTA certainly did, and it has been bad for Mexico and bad for the United States. Interestingly, I just saw a piece in today's Wall Street Journal that said free trade, so-called free trade agreements, which are not really free trade agreements, they're really agreements to have multinational corporations run the world, are falling out of favor. And TPP is not going to – I don't think TPP is going to pass. Certainly Fast Track is not going to pass.
And without Fast Track, meaning Congress would have to vote on it with no filibusters and no amendments, it's very hard for the free trade deal itself involving a dozen Pacific Rim countries. And by the way, Pacific Rim includes Mexico and includes Canada and the United States, in addition to what we think of as, you know, the Pacific nations, the Asian nations. You're reading the political tea leaves. It's funny how there's opposition to that both on left and right, but that's for another show probably.
It probably is for another show, but not that TPP is strictly or even mostly a food issue, but I think that food does give us an opportunity for some kind of odd alliances or maybe groundbreaking alliances between left and right, because it's an issue everyone cares about. No one wants to see their kids poisoned. No one wants to see the earth spoiled. And these are things we're just not talking the same language, but I think there's widespread agreement about these things.
Because in order to blend all these 12 countries' laws with respect to food, it would have to be a lowering of current U.S. standards with respect to food regulation and food safety.
Well, that's part of it, but it also could be a demand on the part of U.S. corporations that countries with higher standards lower their standards in order to buy our products. That's what's happening with Europe. I mean, that's not specifically the TPP, but whatever the Atlantic one is called.
Right. Oh, 'cause
we are making demands on Europe to accept pesticides and other chemicals use in crop growing that they don't traditionally accept.
And GMOs is another source of disagreement on current standards between the United States and Europe. That's part of the Chipotle story, taking GMOs out of their agreements. There are signs up in the restaurants now. What's your position on GMOs? Because I think the scientific community is kind of split on whether these pose a danger or the danger is as manufactured as the food served at McDonald's.
This is going to be a long answer, I'm afraid, but the technology, I don't think, is dangerous at all. The way it's been used is dangerous. So I think we need to make a distinction between those two things. There's nothing wrong, doesn't seem to be anything wrong with gene splicing. But if you gene splice in order to make crops tolerant to herbicides, all you're doing is upping chemical applications, and chemical applications are demonstrably harmful. And, you know, not to get too specific, but glyphosate, which is the main ingredient in Roundup, which is the herbicide used on genetically engineered corn, has been declared a probable carcinogen. And it's not far from being a probable carcinogen to a definite carcinogen. So if you're a farm worker, you don't want to be exposed to that.
Melanie in Lock Harbor, you're on WNYC with Mark Bittman. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. I was just calling in because I do feel food prices by the fall probably will go up because we have the drought in California, the loss of a lot of cattle in Texas, and the chickens that have been slaughtered for this avian flu, which, sad to say, you don't hear very much about except on WNYC, NPR.
And it's hundreds of thousands of chickens. Between that and the California drought, which certainly has been in the news, What impact? Do you see an impact?
I mean, I agree. I think prices could go up. But prices need to go up because food is produced better, not because not out of desperation and not because food is produced worse. I mean, why is there avian flu? It's not because chickens are being raised under good conditions. That's for sure.
Dan in Queens, you're on WNYC with Mark Bittman. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Mark. I was just wondering your thoughts on food subsidies. You know, crops like corn and soy are subsidized by the government. Makes certain foods that would be a little more expensive, such as cattle, you know, chicken, things like that, cheaper to produce, but not necessarily healthier for us. And also makes, you know, the crops cheaper artificially, not really what the real prices are. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on subsidies are.
Well, we've subsidized, for want of a better term, industrial agriculture for going on 40 or 50 years at this point, and it has brought us environmental and nutritional, that is, health damage. So the thing to subsidize is real food, and specifically fruits and vegetables. Instead, we're subsidizing highly processed food, and specifically we're subsidizing things that don't even go for food, such as animal food and ethanol. So, yeah, subsidies need to be turned around for sure.
Frank in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank. Can I go to line 8 there? There we go. Now we have Frank. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Yes, hi. I would, very curious, we've been going towards organic produce and things, and when it doesn't cost that much more. But at the end of the day, I wonder why is organic fruit unblemished in most cases? I would think something grown totally organic could have blemishes, could have a hole in it, and yet the gallo apples that I pay a lot more organic for organic gallows, they don't look any different than the regular gallows. So,
do you know the answer, Mark?
It's a tough question, really. I think I would say, A, the less good-looking ones are being sold to people other than you. B, probably people in organics have worked hard to reduce blemishes. But C, I think there's a difference between the letter of organic law and the spirit of organic law. And if you're apples are a bad example, but if you're doing monoculture, that is, if you have 1,000 acres of grapes, let's say, the difference between organic and not organic is much, much less than it would be if you were looking at organic food from, say, a farm that was growing 30 or 40 different crops. I mean, organic should mean diversification. It should mean integrated pest management. It should mean a lot of different things.
Is it the wrong first thing for health-conscious consumers or environment-conscious consumers to look for?
Well, the right first thing is to look for fruits and vegetables, which is something we don't do, and to avoid hyper-processed food. Organic is certainly a better option than not organic, but we know that it costs more, and it's not the most important thing.
Finally, with the 2016 campaign looming, is there any one very, you know, relatable, frameable, accessible food issue that you would put on the presidential candidates' plates? Because there's only probably room for one.
Well, you know, I'm spending a lot of time trying to answer that question. And my gut reaction is something like, let's stop poisoning our children. And that would be, and the best action we could take would be to limit the marketing of junk to kids. I think that's got to be a really, really high priority for anyone who takes food seriously.
Mark Bittman, food columnist for the New York Times and author now of A Bone to Pick. It's a collection of his columns, the good and bad news about food, with wisdom and advice on diets, food safety, GMOs, farming, and more, says the subtitle. Again, the title, A Bone to Pick. You doing any public appearances? Anything you want to promote?
Well, thank you for asking, but no.
Not
they're
as
done.
Of now.
They're
okay.
Done.
Well, they got you here.
Yep.
Mark, thank you.
Thanks for
we'll
having
keep talking.
Me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.